This interview is brought to you by Panasonic Lumix G cameras for today's photographer. Okay, I've got a very special interview for you today. A gentleman contacted me online to basically give us his thoughts on the whole intellectual property confusion that seems to be out there. Lots of people don't know what intellectual property is, what are patent trolls, what is a patent, all that good stuff. So Alan Melzer, he's an intellectual property attorney. He contacted me and offered to offer his knowledge to the TWIP universe. So Alan, welcome to This Week in Photo.
Thank you.
All right, it's good to have you. So, all right, let's just start off with some background on who you are and, you know, maybe a little bit of why you can speak to this topic.
Okay. I've got really two backgrounds. One is in the photography area and video, and the other is in the intellectual property area. Mm-hmm. Like many of your listeners, I started in photography when I was in seventh grade, and the first time I saw the print come out of the darkroom, I was hooked. Did the usual things with the yearbook photography, the newspaper, and then in college, I discovered motion pictures. Hmm. Took a number of courses in college and did a documentary while I was in college on a theater group. I graduated from University of Pennsylvania with an engineering degree in electrical engineering. From there, I went to law school, and I continued my interest in motion pictures. And in that day, I would say I'm probably the same age as Rick Salmon. So I've got a lot of history. So in that day, it was all film. It wasn't digital at that point. So I made a film during the Vietnam War, a November moratorium, and then an airport film when you could roam the airport any way you wanted and nobody bothered you.
You could actually bring a camera into the airport?
Oh, you could go right on the tarmac. You could walk out the door where people boarded at any time of the day and just walk around on the tarmac and nobody bothered you. From there, I still had the burning interest in film and photography, so I went to BU in their master's program in cinematography. Mm-hmm. After that, I said, well, I don't know whether I want to be a filmmaker or a lawyer, so I took the – some people don't agree, but I think I took the easy way out and became a lawyer. And because of my engineering background, I always had an interest in intellectual property. And in those days, it was in its infancy. And so it was a real esoteric specialty at that point. So initially, I was at Fort Monmouth in New Jersey at the Army Materiel Command, learned my basic patent law there, then went on to Xerox in California and counseled their microelectronics center and was there for the early days of PARC.
Wow.
The Palo Alto Research Center.
Yeah, Xerox PARC, yeah.
Yeah. And then after that, went into private practice and have been there, been in private practice in Washington for about the last 30 years.
Wow. So you know your way around a law or two.
Right. And I'd say around 2008, I rediscovered photography because up until that point, I was doing I transitioned to video from motion picture film and started doing documentaries for nonprofit groups. And then I rediscovered in 2008, I rediscovered photography and digital photography. And I was just blown away with what you could do because I left photography when it was still film. And so I hadn't been there for the early days of the development of digital. And right. So
you left the kid when it was a teenager and came back and he's a middle-aged right. man now.
after it grew up and got some sense.
Yeah.
So, and in my practice, I've been exposed to all the areas, patents, trademarks, copyrights. I primarily spend most of my time in the patent area. And in that regard, I've had an opportunity to represent some companies in the photography area, in the video area. So I felt at my age that it was time for me to give back and do something that I really enjoy. And this type of thing combines both my interest in photography with my experience in the law.
Oh, that's perfect. Well, I can tell you, me speaking selfishly, I definitely need some schooling on this stuff because, you know, as you know, on the show, we talk about just the law as it surrounds photographers and photography and what you can and can't do and what is and what isn't yours and all that stuff. And it's still blurry to me. You know, I had Jack Resnicki on talking about copyright, and just like 3-4 minutes into the interview, I was like, oh man, I'm in trouble. You know,
yeah,
and all these images I have that aren't protected, that are on Flickr and all this stuff. And we can create, like you're saying, with the advent of digital technology, we can create some amazing looking images and share them while we're driving. I can take a picture of something great and share it while I'm at a traffic light if I want to. But after I do that, what's the law around it? Is it mine? You know, that right. sort of thing.
Yeah, and I've read his book. It's a really good read. It's an easy read. And he warns you whenever there's legal jargon. So,
yeah, it is a really good book. I was looking at my bookshelf to see where it is because I need to pull it out again. So let's jump into it. Intellectual property. You know, so let's start by defining what it is. I mean, is it property that can only be owned by intellectuals, or what? What is intellectual property?
If you judge by Hollywood, it may not be the case. But intellectual property in its most basic form is creations of the mind. It can be inventions. It can be literary expressions. And there are two types of property. There's intangible property and real property. Now, real property is land. Intangible property is something that's more ephemeral. So the types of intellectual property, and once again, it's a creation of the mind. So anything that the mind can create is intellectual property. And the types of intellectual property are patents, trademarks, copyrights, designs, and trade secrets. And those are the basic forms, and that is the sphere of intellectual property.
Okay, so then, looking at, you say anything that the mind can create. So I would argue, and I'm arguing with a lawyer here, so I'm in trouble. So I would argue that the mind creates everything, right? So everything is intellectual property because the mind's created the Mac, mind's created a photo that I take, mind's create, you know, some an email or a poem that I write or anything, right?
Right. And those can all be protected. Those are all forms of intellectual property. When you compose an email, when you take a photo, when you do a painting, when you create a stage production, a play, those are all forms of intellectual property. Now, within the groups that I've mentioned, they all have specific meanings. So, for example, if you want me to go into this, I can tell you the differences between a patent, a trademark, and a copyright.
Yeah, that'd be great. I know we're going to get to that later, but I want to hear about that now. What's the difference between those?
Okay. A patent is a property right that's granted by the government for an invention. And the right that you get if you're able to obtain a patent is the right to exclude others from making, using, offering for sale, or selling the invention that's covered by the patent. Mm-hmm. A trademark, on the other hand, is a word, a name, a symbol, or a device that is used in trade to indicate the source of the goods or services. And that's the purpose of the trademark. The copyright is a form of protection provided to authors of original works of authorship. And those could be literary, they could be dramatic, musical, artistic, both published and unpublished. So those are the three basic categories of intellectual property.
Great. Okay, got it. So those all fit into the overall umbrella of intellectual property. So then that's it. That segues into the photographers, you know, both amateur and pro. Let's take them both separately. So you're an amateur or an advanced amateur photographer, and I use the term amateur as in someone who's not deriving their primary source of income from taking pictures. So why should they care about intellectual property if you're an amateur photographer?
Okay. When dealing with whether it's an amateur or a professional, there's really two aspects to the law that are for consideration. One is the aspects of law that apply to the creation of the photo, and when you can't take photos and things like that, the privacy issues and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. That's not what I'm going to cover today. But the other aspect of it is, after you've taken the photograph, how do you protect it? And that's the aspect that I'm going to deal with today. Great. Now, from a practical standpoint, when you say amateur, are you saying amateur in the true sense of the word, in that they're doing it for the love of it and not for profit?
Correct. Yeah, for the love of.
Right. Right, for the love of. So for an amateur, they have much more leeway, because from a practical standpoint, a company that has something that a photo taken by an amateur might infringe is typically not going to go after them. For example, when an amateur creates a slideshow and uses commercial music, the chances of them running into any problem are non-existent. Mm-hmm. Or if an amateur takes a picture that includes a logo from, let's say, a McDonald's or a well-known logo, like an air freshener in your car, the chances are nothing's going to happen. Now, where the amateur can run into issues, which would be similar to what a professional will run into, is when they start to post them on the internet and they start to promote their photos through a website or through Flickr or through something like that. Mm-hmm. So there are, let's see, you'll cut this pause out. But, sure. Okay. So an amateur, like a professional, is concerned if they're going to use something that belongs to someone else, such as a logo, as I mentioned before. Mm-hmm. In certain situations, I'm going to segue into the other law just to bring it into context, but an amateur as well as a professional is allowed to go out and photograph anything that's in the public. Where the professional runs into an issue is where a locale, for example, New York City, has ordinances that control a professional taking pictures in New York. Mm-hmm. The amateur is not plagued by this issue. The other thing is where a professional would take pictures that would include a logo or an architectural rendition that is on private property where it's considered to be something that you can't take care of. For example, it doesn't apply in the United States, but the Louvre has specific France has specific laws against taking pictures of the Louvre, mm-hmm, for profit without permission. So an amateur really doesn't have too much to worry about, and from a practical standpoint, can't run into trouble. Now, an interesting thing is that an amateur, when they take pictures of their family, the person who takes the picture is the author. And so they own the copyright to that photo.
Right.
And it's entirely possible that at some point in the future, should that photo be sold or otherwise exploited by people in the family, then the issues that are similar to what a professional would face could arise. But in a general rule, amateurs don't have much to worry about. And it's only when they start to exploit a photo on the internet and it starts to dilute a protectable interest owned by a third party that they run into trouble.
So it sounds like an interweaving of intellectual property and copyright when you get into that area. And then, you know, and of course, all the stuff we talked about with Jack Resnicki with regard to model releases and all that stuff. So you sound like if I take a photo of, say, a family member, I am the intellectual property owner. However, that person that I took a photo of, if they haven't given me explicit permission to use that, I may own it, but I can't really use it. Correct?
You can use it if you're not going to charge for it.
Got it.
Okay. The minute you start to charge, then you've got to have a model release.
Okay, gotcha.
And that's what the professional photographer runs into. Mm-hmm. There's much greater restriction regarding what they can photograph. And you run into this all the time when you go into museums or you go to zoos. There's always a special category for the professional. The amateur, they say, for example, in Washington, we have the baseball team. And when you go to we have the Nationals baseball team. When you go to one of their games, if you go to their website, they tell the amateur how long the lens can be. It can't be greater than 7 inches.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
It is, but Canon came out with their new 70 to 300 L lens, which is less than 7 inches.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm thinking. That was written by somebody who doesn't understand, you know, advanced photography optics, right?
Right. They figure if you got a big lens, then you're going to be taking professional pictures. So.
Exactly. Well, he's, wow, that's a big camera. You must be a really good photographer.
Right. That's right. I love when people say that to me.
Yeah.
When they see a photo I've taken and they say how great it is and they go, wow, what camera do you have? Exactly. That's because you got a better camera than I do.
Exactly. It's like telling a chef, wow, this tastes delicious. What stove did you use?
Right.
Same. So what about professionals? So we touched a little bit on professionals. How does all this stuff affect the person that's out there taking photos, you know, with the explicit purchase or purpose of making money from the photo?
Well, the professional is under much greater restriction, both in what they can photograph without permission, mm-hmm. and then how they can exploit what they photograph. And if you're taking pictures of people, now I'll carve out the exception early and then we'll talk about the problems that you might have if you're going to exploit the photos you make. Certainly photojournalists have a much wider range of what they can do, especially when it's considered to be news. So where they may take photos of people who are in the public, they don't have to get their permission to put it into a newspaper or on a TV show or a news show on TV or something like that.
Yeah.
Now, the professional who's doing it to take photos and then exploit those to make a living, as I said, they're under greater restriction regarding what they can photograph without permission. And if they're going to take pictures of individuals or small groups of individuals, they need model releases. And generally, they're going to want to perfect the copyright. Now, under the copyright law, the minute you create the image, the minute you've taken the photograph and put it into some permanent form, whether it be in digital form or an actual print, we say that the copyright obtains and the author is the photographer.
Mm-hmm.
But once they want to start exploiting that photograph and they want to protect themselves, they're going to want to register that copyright.
Got it.
And they register with the federal government, and there's a modest charge for doing it. I think in most cases, a photographer if they're highly skilled, will be able to decipher the form to fill out. And if they have trouble, they can contact the copyright office and get help. But generally, it's not a difficult form to fill out, and it's a modest fee. I think it's $35.
Now, Alan, would you, considering all this stuff, and I know a lot of photographers are thinking, wow, this is a lot of details, and, you know, I just want to take pictures. You know, what if they want to engage with an attorney to or lawyer to help them understand, and whatever their particular vocation of photography is, say they're, you know, a part-time guy that I like to take pictures and go on photo walks, but on weekends I do the occasional wedding, and, you know, if they have maybe a semi-complex situation like that, and they decide to seek out legal advice just to make sure all bases are covered, how do they do that, and what are they looking to pay, or like what are they going to pay?
Right. There's a lot of ways to approach this, and it's an old rule in the law that an attorney who represents himself has a fool for a client. And I guess the corollary is a photographer who thinks he can do legal work has a fool for a client. I think the most difficult thing is to find an attorney who's going to be sympathetic to your situation. And by that, I mean somebody who's not going to charge you a lot to do something that's rather simple. And so let's take the case where you're a part-time wedding photographer. You've got to create a contract. So you could go to the, the WIPPI?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, WPPI.
And they've got model agreements. If you want to engage an attorney to keep your costs down, you should take something like that, and if you can read it, if they've written it in a language that's understandable, then make a list of the things that you feel are important in the contract that you want to ultimately use to cover when you do a wedding. By taking those two things to an attorney, it'll take an attorney, since they charge by time, it'll take them less time to review and comment. And then once you've gotten that contract, you can use it over and over again. So, and it shouldn't cost more than, it depends on what kind of attorney you go to, but maybe $500, maybe less than that. And depending on how complex you want to make the agreement, the cost is going to go up. But generally, you're making an investment similar to investing in a tripod.
Yeah.
Tripod turns out to be an important piece of equipment, but people don't think of it that way, but it's the same type of thing. You're investing in an agreement that you can use for all the work that you do, and you've made that investment, and it hasn't cost you a tremendous amount of money.
What about the photographers that say, wow, $500, I could use that towards a new lens. I'm going to, instead of taking Alan's advice, I am going to Google wedding contract and find one and just put my name at the top of it. What are the risks involved with that?
The risks are, as anything that you Google, it's where you end up and what type of document you're going to get. That's why I recommend one of the organizations that deal with the type of photography that you're interested in. For example, the American Society of Media Photographers have an excellent section on copyright. And a lot of these organizations and groups have sample documents that you can use and feel comfortable using them. Mm-hmm. It's when you go to some other site that you don't know who it is. It may be an attorney that's trying to promote themselves, or it may be someone who's entered a group and said, yeah, this is a contract I've used and I haven't had any trouble with it. You're really most concerned about what the rights and obligations are. And under those circumstances, you have to be careful as to what the source of the sample agreement is.
Got it. Interesting. All right. One other question I had on here on the list here is about patents. You know, we talk a lot about patent trolls and, you know, in a negative context, that these are either, you know, nefarious people that are out there filing patents so that one day, and sitting on them so that one day if somebody infringes on it, they can pounce and have a big payday. Can you define what a patent troll is, you know, from a, you know, from the horse's mouth? What is a patent troll, and are they necessarily bad, and just sort of demystify that?
Okay, a patent troll is a person or company who buys and enforces patents against one or more alleged infringers. And typically they have no intention of manufacturing, developing, or marketing the patent invention, and they're characterized by the use of aggressive patent lawsuits.
Okay, so these are the people that are, they may have a patent for, say, the, I'm just pulling this out of the air, for the technology behind the JPEG algorithm, and they're not gonna make any image processing software. They're just gonna sit on it and wait for companies like Adobe to incorporate it, and when they do, they pull in the patent lawyers and go get paid, correct?
But What typically happens is, especially in the high technology area, it costs a lot of money to get the patent initially. And what the patent troll is looking for is a company that's on hard times or has gone bankrupt and has a patent portfolio that they can pick up very inexpensively.
Oh.
And patent lawsuits are very expensive. In today's market, you're talking $1 million, $2 million for a full-blown patent suit. And depending on the complexity of the technology and the number of patents involved, it can be more than that. So, but I read something very interesting about Apple, that they joined forces with a patent troll called, the name escapes me now. It was something... Digivice or something like that, where the patent troll contacted Apple and said, "We're going to sue you on the smartphones. We have a whole host of patents that cover it." So what Apple did was enter into a cross license with them, and then had the patent troll go out and fight their battles for them. So Apple didn't have to go out and do that. So that's a novel use of the patent troll that had not been done before.
Yeah. I had no idea. That was very interesting what you said earlier about how the patent troll entity will, in essence, it sounded like a lot like nature, like say in the ocean, where the predators look for wounded or otherwise sick fish to eat, you know, before they go after the healthy ones. So they look. The patent troll is going to look for companies that can't afford a legal defense, and threaten them with these $1 million lawsuits in hopes that they'll just settle for half that or something. Is that a good characterization?
Yes, and actually it mixes both ways, because the patent troll is looking for wounded companies to buy the patents cheap, which they will then go out and file multiple lawsuits against companies of all sizes. But they'll typically go after the smaller, weaker companies first to get them to settle. And then when they go to the larger companies, they'll say, "We've already had 7 or 8 companies take licenses."
Jeez. Well, this sounds like, I mean, it sounds like it's not a secret, right? I mean, it sounds like this is a widely known problem. Are there any movement to get this rectified, or is there any way that we're going to be able to fix this, or is it just going to go on like this?
Well, it's going to go on until the Congress does something about it. But at this point, on the flip side of it, it's a way for example, let's say there's a company that has some patents that dominate a technology, mm-hmm. and they can't afford to file a lawsuit. They could associate with a patent troll, and many times the patent trolls are investment companies or companies that are set up expressly for monetizing the patents, and therefore get investors to put money in to fund the lawsuits. So a small company could sell a piece of the interest. And what's unique about these patent trolls is that the attorneys who handle the cases for him don't get paid until they're a success. So they only need to pay the expenses. And then once there's been success, then they divide up the profits. But on the side that says it's a good thing, it's a way to exploit a patent and monetize it, even though there's no product.
Got it. Got it. All right. Let's talk about some myths around intellectual property and sort of have you clarify and rectify, you know, this stuff. So if you at the top of your head, could you list, like, say, I don't know, three to five common misconceptions with regard to intellectual property and set the record straight?
Yeah. What I'll do is I'll try to go. I'll give some from copyright, some from trademark, some from patent.
Okay.
Now, one that applies to all is the improper use of the various symbols. You've seen the circle with the R, the circle with the C.
Yep.
And then the TM and SM. A copyright uses a circle with the C. And since the law was passed, I think it was 1976, the requirement to use the circle with the C is no longer there. So just because you haven't marked your photographs with a copyright notice somewhere doesn't mean that they're not copyrighted. Mm-hmm. But there is an advantage to putting the world on notice that it is copyrighted because it will discourage the copying, but it's not a requirement. The circle with the R means that you have a registered trademark with the federal government, and you can only use that when you actually have it. But if you have a trademark that you're using every day, and I'm sure you've seen this, before you get the registration, you can mark it TM for trademark or SM for service mark. So, for example, a McDonald's clearly has a circle with an R, but sometimes they'll introduce new marks. And let's say that they've come up with a restaurant concept that they've given a name to. They might use an SM, a service mark, if they're going to associated with that. With that, they're going to also give out unique products that have names. They're going to use a TM. And then that puts the world on notice that they regard those marks as trademarks to identify the source of the goods and services.
Yep.
Now, in the trademark area, some people think that registering a company name with the state or a domain name on the internet is the same as having a registered trademark, and that's not the case. A trademark can only be protected and registered with the federal government. Anything short of that, at best, you have what we call a common law trademark, and that's only enforceable in the area where you actually have it, the geographic area. So just because you register your name and you get a unique name registered in the state where you have your business, or you get a domain name available to you, that doesn't act the same as a trademark. On the copyright area, some people think that if you acknowledge the author, or if you don't charge for it, or you copy only a small portion, or to get a little esoteric, you change Pantone colors, that you're not going to infringe a copyright. But that's not the case. It's really the quality of what you've appropriated rather than the quantity. And the thing about copyright, which distinguishes it from patent, is that the copyright does not protect the underlying idea. Mm-hmm. So you could have two photographs of Washington Monument and they would not be infringements. Whereas in patents, you're actually covering the underlying idea. The copyright only protects the expression of the idea, whereas the patent protects the idea itself. Now, on the patent side, some people think that if they have a patent, that allows them to practice the invention. And that's not the case. The only thing that the law grants under the patent is that you have the right to exclude others from making, using, selling, offering for sale of the product that's covered in the patent.
Okay.
And one way to understand this is that you could get a patent on an improvement, and someone else has a patent that dominates what you've done. And I think the simplest example was one I learned in law school, where a guy comes up with a patent for a pail that'll hold some liquid, and he gets a patent on it. Then years later, someone comes up with the idea of putting a handle on that pail, and she gets a patent on that improvement. Well, when you go to try to sell the pails with handles, you're still going to infringe the patent on the pail.
Jeez.
And so that's why just because you have a patent doesn't mean that you can practice what's in it. It only means you can prevent others from doing it.
Got it. It's a blocker.
Right.
Okay.
And those are, you know, some myths. These are the most prominent myths in the various areas of intellectual property.
That's great. That's awesome. This has been very educational. Again, my head is about to explode. basically when I have these kinds of conversations, it just lets me know that, hey, there's a lot of ice below the waterline with that iceberg.
Yeah.
So, and I think it pays to get yourself educated and talk to people that actually do this kind of thing for a living if you're in any way, concerned about this stuff. So, that said, what are some resources that photographers can use to learn more about, intellectual property, patents, trademarks, and that sort of thing?
Well, certainly Wikipedia has some great articles on it. As I mentioned before, the American Society of Media Photographers, their website is really good in terms of copyright. The Patent and Trademark Office has some excellent articles on patent law and trademark law, and they have an interactive site that allows you to learn how to use the forms. And the Copyright Office similarly has that type of thing. The only caution I would give is patents are a really unique animal. I call patents the ultimate in nitpicking. So. While trademark and copyright, you can go and fill out the form as a layperson and feel fairly comfortable, I wouldn't advise that in the patent area. Because in patents, your whole property right is defined by a sentence or a group of sentences that are at the end of the written description of the patent. And that's a very esoteric practice to be able to create these what are called claims to protect the property right. Whereas in trademark and copyright, what you have is in a more tangible form. The International Trademark Association has some excellent advice. American Intellectual Property Association. And NAPP, of course, whereas Nikki is, has some excellent videos there.
Yeah.
Amazon, if you do a search on intellectual property, you'll find some excellent books. And another site that I've really enjoyed is AllTop, ALLTOP.com. And you just put in intellectual property or patents or trademarks, whatever you're interested in, and they'll direct you to the most popular sites that deal with that subject matter.
Yeah.
And, of course, the iTunes store has apps for the iPhone and the iPad that cover the basics of intellectual property.
Wow. There's an app for that, huh?
Right. That's right.
Now, what about you? If folks want to contact you or see, what you're working on, are you online anywhere? Or are you just sort of, kind of come up when people ring the bell for intellectual property?
Right. My firm site is jhip.com. That's the law practice site. We're a boutique intellectual property firm in Washington, D.C. And we cover all aspects of patents, trademark, copyrights, trade secrets, confining everything to the intellectual property area. And I have a site that's under construction now where I show some of my photographs called melserphotography.com. And I'm in the process of formalizing that site to make it look more professional.
Wonderful. What was that URL again?
Melser, M-E-L-S-E-R, photography, one word, .com.
Got it. Excellent. Well, Alan, thanks for taking the time this morning / afternoon to chat with me about this stuff. And you've given me a headache now. So
okay. Well,
in a good way, you know, it's good to know where the voids are that you need to fill in. And intellectual property, like we were saying, intellectual property, trademarks, patents, all this stuff is an important part of being a photographer. If you don't understand what you're exposing yourself to, you can't safeguard against it. Correct?
Especially in today's world.
Yeah, there are patent trolls out there swimming around for the folks that have that kind of problem. But you know, on the creative side, it pays to understand the law. I think to understand how to protect yourself and what you can and can't do with the images that you take.
Yeah, and there's really some simple guidelines. It's like that old commercial for the Fram filter. You can pay me now or pay me later.
But I'm going to get paid. Right?
I think what you really need to do is to find an attorney who's not going to say to you, you can't do this, you can't do that. It's to give you the guidance to allow you to do what you want to do and protect you at the same time.
So along with that 24-70, the 70-200, and that full frame camera in your bag, you should also have a lawyer. All right, Alan, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it.